Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland.
Oh, I wish there's a mole.
First Nations and our people that been living here for thousands of years.
Stand up.
We've been fighting for our freedom since the Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria.
Stand up.
Like Geronimo, Sitting Bull, Red Cloud, Crazy Horse, Leonard Peltier.
Stand up.
Now they poisoning the waters for our sons and our daughters, so we on the frontier.
We won.
One nation, one cause, one people, one tribe. Now it's us against the pipeline.
This is Lakota Cheyenne Mole Robin White, and I'm your host for today's Indigenous Peoples Day Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. Every week, the Old Mole brings you news and views from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, decolonizing perspective. The opening music for today's show included the all-star cast of Stand Up for Standing Rock. Now for the rundown on what's on today's show. Nimiipuu Mole Julian Ankeny speaks with Julian Matthews, founder of the NGO Nimiipuu Protecting the Environment, and advocate for freeing the snake. Julian Matthews is also coordinator of the Nimiipuu Canoochuk Project, a healing journey. And I can't express enough the importance of the canoe journeys in cultural resurgence. I urge you all to research about the canoe journey. And after Julian's interview, I'm going to be interviewing Rachel Cushman, tribal council member of the Chinook Nation tribe, about the Chinook struggle for federal recognition. Before we launch into Julian's interview, a few words about some upcoming events for Indigenous Peoples Week. Many of these will be at Washington State University, Vancouver. We'll post the information and Zoom links on today's show on our page. Here's the lineup sponsored by Native Programs and the Collective for Social and Environmental Justice. Wednesday, October 12th, 12:05 to 1:20 p.m. in the Vancouver Library, room 261, and on Zoom, Federal Recognition and Indigenous Sovereignty, featuring Sam Robinson, Vice Chairman of the Chinook Indian Tribe, and Lana Jack, Salilo YM activist, speaking respectively on the Chinook and Salilo YM struggles for self-determination, moderated by Robin White, Lakota Cheyenne activist. I know that guy. In person in Vancouver Library, room 261, or on Zoom. Thursday, October 13th, 10:35 to 11:50, in Vancouver Library, room 260, and on Zoom, Free the Snake and Nimiipuu Canoe Project, a Healing Journey, featuring Julian Matthews of the Nimiipuu Protecting the Environment, facilitated by Julian Ankeny, coordinator of Native Programs. In person in Vancouver Library, 260, or on Zoom. Thursday, October 13th, 12:05 to 1:20 in Vancouver Library 260 and on Zoom, Heart of the Monster, Nimiipuu Creation Story with Julian Ankeny, coordinator of Native Programs, in person in Vancouver Library 260 or on Zoom. All events listed above are at the Washington State University Vancouver campus in the library. So now we go to Julian Ankeny speaking with Julian Matthews about breaching the dams on the Lower Snake River and about the Nimiipuu Canoe Project.
Totslahane, Oikolo, good day everyone. Nimiipuu Mole here, Julian Ankeny, coming to you straight from the WSU campus. We want to give a big war whoop. Oh, welcome today to Julian Matthews. Julian Matthews is the founder of Nimiipuu Protecting the Environment, an advocate for Free the Snake. They protect our treaty areas, educate the tribal members and youth on current environmental issues, develop leaders in environmental areas for the next generation, promote activism within our tribes and communities, empower tribal members to effect change. He is also the coordinator for the Canoe Project, a healing journey for our own community. Ketiao Yao, thank you again, Julian, for being here.
Sure. Thanks a lot for the intro, and thanks for having me speak here with the people. But the dam breaching, that was a big issue. We we started pushing that about 4 years ago to save, restore salmon. And now the tribe got on board, which is really cool. We've been doing a lot of stuff with them, with the tribe, like different events. And we did the totem journeys for the Lummi tribe, July 20. And they took it all over the country. Then we went where they stopped, like Snake River. That's what ours was, totem journey, Snake River. We all flew back to Washington, did a gave a speech on the mall, and Secretary Holland was there. And then right now, I think the it's a tipping point for this dam breaching, if we've ever had it, because right now with Biden's new report just came out last week about dam breaching, that I hope it, you know, this will be the result is the dams will be breached. And our tribe's still meeting with Simpson, Mike Simpson. He's a really good advocate for it. And it's so strange because he's a Republican from Idaho, you know, like, you hear all this stuff about Idaho. It's like, you're dam breaching. It's just funny. That's great he's doing it. So a lot of people are supportive of it.
So I've been talking, and for Indigenous people to continue to occupy a liminal space that accounts for both the political and racialized natures of our identity, and how U.S. policies and treaties towards Indigenous people are basically rooted in imperialism and white supremacy and a desire for material gain. Can you speak to how the damming of the snakes affects our tribal sovereignty, and why these Indigenous-led resistance movements to protect watersheds are so crucial in our lives today?
The rivers and the water with us, it's the salmon, you know, everything needs water, clean water. And the dams have really impacted that because we have a treaty right. And that's the big issue, that it's good to see that people are fighting for the water rights, because critical as far as a people, you know, water is really is part of our culture, is part of us. And we have, and that's what I asked NEPIC probably about 6 months ago. I said, well, who owns that water? Who owns those salmon? You know, no one said nothing, because we don't own it. They don't own it. I don't own it. But the thing about it, you know, particularly being Indigenous here, being a part of this land ecosystem, I guess they call it nowadays, is that we want to protect it and we don't want to exploit it, you know, because really essentially the dams are exploitation of the water, and the salmon are just in the way, you know, like, because they want that hydroelectric power, you know, like they like cheap electric, and they say we need that, you know, we don't need that. But it's kind of like I tell people, a lot of the way they deal with it, whether it's timber cuts up on the subway locks off, or, you know, road building, whatever, wherever they go, I guess, like they want to commercialize it and commodify everything, make everything, like, how much can we make out of it? How much is this water worth to us? And how much electric can this generate? How much money can we make? How much can we cut timber and make money off of that? But I think that sovereignty and that treaty rights is really the big issue here. Like, we were here, you know, like I have this sticker I always put on my thing. It says, we are here first. You know, so they don't own it. It's just like, you know, where Wazoo sits and U of I sits. I live in Pullman. That's on ceded territory. We didn't sell it or give it up. But, you know, that's kind of how people like think, like, oh, you know, Indians aren't here no more, or they don't live here. They don't, you know. In our Constitution, it says the Nez Perce Tribal Executive Committee shall have jurisdiction over all lands within the 1855 treaty. That's pretty clear to me, you know, but it comes down to whether they want to push it. That's really what the issue is. Because even when they first started this dam breaching effort, you know, some of the council were against it. They didn't want us talking about dam breaching because they have an agreement with the BPA, you know, get funding and et cetera. But anyway, it's turned out pretty good now. But like, you know, like I say, you know, a lot of it is you can't commodify everything. That's what's happening to it. How much is it worth? You know, it's just like, how much can we exploit out of this land, water, or timber, or whatever, you know, to make money off? And then they just leave this devastation. You know, like, you look at all the clear cuts around here, whether it's up by on the Coeur d'Alene Reservation, out by St. Mary's, all these clear cuts where they just went through, we need the wood, you know, which is true. But the thing about it is you have to look at ways that you can utilize without destroying, like, fracking. You know, it's terrible. Speakers come a couple years ago and talk about their fracking on their res. And even on the Alberta, we had some speakers from Alberta, tar sands area, Beaver Creek Cree. And this lady was talking about how that starts oozing up in onto her land, you know, and it spoiled the water. And because of that fracking, whatever they do with that. So it's things like that. It affects everyone. You know, you can't have fracking, whether it's Indian or non-Indian, without destroying the land and impacting the environment. So that's, tribes just have to be fighters. You know, it's just like when we first did the megalos, you know, I was surprised the NEPIC and the tribe got out there, because we were fighting that for months before they all went out there, you know, and it's really frustrating. But now that they're on board with it, it's pretty good to see. And that's what we're trying to continue, is continue organizing, getting people involved, kind of like what we're doing right now, get people to know up and down the river, you know, because it is, we have fishing rights on the zone 6 on the Columbia, and we have tribal members up and down the river, whether they're enrolled Nez Perce or enrolled Yakima, Yola, you know, so it's kind of like we're all related. And so we're all trying to combine our efforts to protect that river, Columbia, Snake, and Clearwater, Selway, Locksaw, you know, salmon and all these. So it's really critical that the tribes take a good stand. And that's what we're really pushing. Not all the time, you know, but you know, when we need to, we will push the tribe and get the people behind us, like at general council meetings. And because I think you have to get them behind you, because they do have a certain say or influence. And I think Shannon Wheeler, he's doing a really good job. Sam, right now, you know, it took some pushing, but I'm glad to see they're really working on this dam breaching. Because before, they wouldn't even, you never hear him say that, you know, 5 years ago, you never, you know, so it's kind of the kids, it seems like everything's going good with that kind of two-pronged deal. Reaching and then the kids and youth activities.
Thank you so much, Julian. One of the issues that you grapple with in advocacy work is tribal sovereignty and treaty rights. If we can't catch fish or fish for salmon in our waterways, if they are too polluted, fish die, how will these changes in ecosystems of the rivers and fishing populations affect people 7 generations from now? These are all questions that empower our youth and tribal members to effect change, because they affect us directly. The Lapwe Canoe Project is a healing journey for those involved, young and old, who come together each Wednesday to reclaim traditional canoe carving. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We first started with kind of the idea of the canoe project was we did our first Wawaii Canyon, the flotilla, Free the Snake flotilla, with some other bunch of groups, environmental groups, and some different tribal members, and then some other non-Indians that have been already had canoes, that like Kalispell tribe, Caldwell tribe, Coeur d'Alene tribe. And so after that, we started talking to Gary Dorr, some other people who graduated, was going to law school at the time at U of I, some other people, Jim Jameson. So we started talking about, like, we should get a canoe or we should carve one. And so so we got the first log, and then we took that down to our site in Lapwe. Then we started working on it. Then met a guy at U of I prop, and then some other people that hooked us up with Bull Woodford. He does the after school, Lapwe Elementary School after school program. So we told him, hey, that'd be cool, have the kids come down there and start carving on the canoe. And so that was September of 17, 2017. And so the kids started coming there, 34th and 5th graders, every Wednesday. Most of them were Nez Perce, not all were other tribes, non-Indians, et cetera. So we started carving on it, and then got that done. Took about a year, but we're just doing it every Wednesday and slowly. So, you know, so it was more of, like we did that video, a healing journey, more of the experience of, you know, having the kids come there, having the kids involved, and a lot of other people coming by all the time. It's really interesting. Like, they see the Facebook, they stop by on their way somewhere and talk to us and want to help us out and do stuff and think, you know, give us ideas. And so we got that done about in 2018, about the same time, about May, June. And so then we took it out for the first time in, I believe, in June or July, did a float, test float. And then that year we took it on the flotilla. We floated down from, had some kids, tribal kids, Devin and Lewis Rubin, they were big helpers. So we had some kids, some elders, had a little ceremony down at Middle Hog Island boat ramp. We put the canoe in there and then floated it down to Chief Timothy Park. And that was a long jaunt, because I was thinking, you know, it'd take us, I said, we'll be down there about 2.5 hours. So then we got down there about 7.5 hours later, because I didn't realize when you're floating from the river, you know, and that brings out the issue of the free flowing river. When you're floating on the free flow, man, you're going for it. You don't even have curly after paddle. Then you hit that confluence and that slack water, you slow down. And then we got on the other side of Lewis, and it started getting really choppy. And originally the dugout, it flipped on the first kind of turn. So we had to wait around for them. And then we waited, and then we got back going. Then Elliot and his Vonda and I were in the other one, and it started turning. We flipped that. So the water was really warm. So it was pretty cool. Now we had all these Indian native canoes. It was totally cool, because Kalispell, a bunch of them were with us, you know. So, I mean, it's like all these Indians and canoes on the river. And so that was really kind of awe-inspiring to me. And, you know, it just kind of made me realize how important this was, doing a canoe. And Moscow Charter School gave us a cedar strip canoe. So we used both of those in the last flotilla, which has been a couple of years now. We just took them out down there at the U Salmon Summit last Saturday on the 24th, I believe, and let some of the kids. We had a U Salmon Summit where Burns and Paiute kids were there, some Umatilla, and then a few Nez Perce. So it turned out pretty cool. Kind of give the youth voices, which is one, like you're saying, one of the issues I want to bring out is the kids. Because, you know, it's like I tell them, 20 years from now, I may not be here, but I want to do what I can right now. Young people coming up can still salmon, you know, they don't go extinct on my watch, basically.
Julian, you have definitely already created a lasting legacy for our community, but also for like future generations.
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool because I used to kid them. I call them kids, you know, they're fourth and fifth grade. I used to tell them, no one ever showed me how to carve a canoe. So we did that. Then we started paddle making. Dave Paul, he's a U of I prof. He comes down and carves with the paddle. He has all the equipment. So, and it's really interesting. All the kids really loved him. We're getting the kids program going next Wednesday, like I was saying. And we feed them every week. You know, we give them supplies, do artwork, do bead work, feather work, you know, things like have elders come and talk to them about different things. You know, like Lucy talks to them about the medicines and the plants and stuff. And Tutlow from the language program, he told me, he came over there and said, hey, I'd like to do a curriculum for you guys on Nimiputemt on the canoe. You know, like different actions, carving, you know.
Yeah.
And then Gary Green, I guess I got to get a home. He has one already laid out. So then we can start talking, you know, having the kids learn the Nimiputemt words related to canoe carving, you know, or on the water, you know, woods types, that kind of stuff. So that's really cool. And so that kind of stuff has been turning out just kind of like falling into place, I guess you say. You know, a lot of people come and want to volunteer. Or, you know, the dam breaching is really critical. Like I said, the canoes were designed for that purpose. The theme to be, we can't go up and down the river just like the salmon can't go up and down the river.
Yeah.
And the reason we want the four dams breached is they were designed to be breached, like Bonneville, all the other ones under Columbia, they are all concrete, but these up here were designed to have the earthen part removed, which will allow the free flow of the river, which is better for salmon. So that's our main goal right now.
Thank you again, Katiao Yao. And remember that Indigenous peoples, tribal sovereignty, tribal autonomy, self-determination, self-identification, traditional understandings, and concepts of culture, knowledge, and power take on new meaning when Indigenous people are able to tell our own stories. Today, Julian's work has brought culture as well as advocacy into a contemporary space and the impacts that these resources have on our different communities. Katiao Yao, Julian, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me, and I'm really grateful that you have me on here. So thanks a lot, Julian.
Yes, thank you.
That was the Round Dance song, I Love You. And before that, you were listening to Nimipu Mole, Julian Ankeny, speaking with Julian Matthews, founder of Nimipu Protecting the Environment, talking about the Indigenous-led movement to free the Snake River, and talking also about the Nimipu canoe journey, which is playing an important role in the cultural resurgence. Next up is my interview with Chinook Tribal Council member Rachel Cushman about the Chinook struggle for federal recognition. Hi, I'm Robin White. Welcome to KBOO, the Old Mole Radio Hour. Today I'm speaking with Rachel Cushman. You're a council member on the Chinook Indian Nation. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Background on who you are and what your position is.
Sure. So I'm going to start with an introduction in Chinookwawa, which is the trade language of the Columbia River area and surrounding area. So Shohayam, Rachel Cushman, Naika Yaxul, Naika Tulkum, and Saika Chinook Indian Nation, and Saika Klatsip, Kathlamet, Wakayakum, Willapaw, Pilar Chinook. Hi, my name is Rachel Cushman. I am a citizen of the Chinook Indian Nation. I'm also both an elected and hereditary leader of the Chinook people. I am a direct descendant of Klatsup Chief Wasulta, who was a negotiator and signer at the Anzendart Treaties in 1851. I have hereditary responsibility, and it's my duty to make sure that that is upheld. For those who don't know, the Chinook Indian Nation is comprised of the five westernmost Chinookan-speaking tribes at the mouth of the Columbia River. We are the Kathlamet and Klatsup of present-day Oregon, Wakayakum, Willapaw, and Lower Chinook of what is now Washington State. We have a long history at the mouth of the Columbia River. Our territory is comprised of Klatsup County, part of Columbia County, Wakayakum County, and Pacific County. So our most eastern in our territory is Oak Point, which is just west of Longview. Our territory extends to the mouth from Tillamook Head in the south and the Willapaw North Shore in the north. So a little bit about myself. As I said, I have a leadership responsibility. I wear a lot of different hats with the tribes. I serve on the Natural Resources and Food Sovereignty Committee. I also do a lot of educational liaisoning in the state of Oregon. I am one of the leaders of our communications team, which is running currently the Chinook Justice Campaign. I'm also a scholar and PhD student in Indigenous Race and Ethnic Studies at the University of Oregon. I am an Indian Collective Changemaker Fellow and a mom, amongst many other things that I do. But yeah, that's a little bit about me.
I like the idea of, you know, it seems like the people in Indian country have to wear a lot of hats and do a lot of things. And I think, you know, when we talk about that, we need to talk about capacity and what it's like trying to survive in this world as an individual Indian or as an organization, a native organization, or even a recognized tribe or unrecognized tribe, and what that capacity problem is about how trying to do all the jobs and why we need allies and why we need people helping us. And I sure appreciate all the work that you do in the Indian country. I know that I come across you all the time, and the work that you do is really appreciated. Let's talk about Chinook Justice.
Okay, so Chinook Justice is a very important campaign for the Chinook Indian Nation. For decades, the Chinook Indian Nation has been fighting to be recognized in the eyes of the federal government. Federal recognition for the Chinook Indian Nation would benefit the lived experience of Chinookan people. But before I dive into the current state of Chinook justice, I just wanted to talk a little bit about our history, because that's so important. The Chinook people today, I'd say, are not federally recognized because we refuse to move out of our Aboriginal territory. In Oregon and Washington, there's a lot of confederacies that exist today. And that's a product of relocation, of removing Indigenous peoples from their homelands and putting them on reservations in different areas. And in 1851, the treaty that I mentioned that my grandfather was a negotiator and signer for, the federal government intended to move the Chinook people at the mouth of the Columbia River to east of the Cascades. And we refused to move. And you know, after several days over a week of negotiating, we were able to sign a treaty with the federal government that would allow us to stay in our homelands in a reduced capacity. For us, place is everything. It's our identity, and the bones of our ancestors are part of our religious beliefs. And being removed from place and being removed from the bones of our ancestors would strip us of our identity, and we did not want that. So we were able to negotiate that. Unfortunately, those treaties went to DC and were tabled. They weren't denied, they were just tabled. And that left a lot of hardship for the Chinook people, because we kept our end of the deal. We, you know, we moved off the landscape into our longstanding villages, but that meant that we weren't able to do a lot of the things that were needed to happen in order to survive the winter. The federal government had agreed that they'd be sending provisions. Those provisions never came. And that was a really, really hard winter for my community. So we were already struggling because of the pandemics that were coming through, and a lot of people were dying. So hunger and starvation on top of the pandemics was just a horrific experience. And a couple of years later, in 1855, we joined the Chehalis River Treaty Council, which comprised of a lot of tribes of the Columbia River area, Southwest Washington, Northwest Oregon. And the intent of the Chehalis River Treaty Council was the government, led by Isaac Stevens at the time, wanted to move all of the people away from the river and out of Southwest Washington into the Olympic Peninsula. And we had learned a lot in those several years between treaty negotiations. And we decided, our leadership decided, amongst other tribal leaderships, that we were not going to move to the Olympic Peninsula and be something that we are not. And one of the chiefs of the Chinook people slammed his fist against the table and said, "Before, we didn't know what you were saying. Now we do, and we're not doing it." And they walked out. Chinook wasn't the only folks that walked out. Chehalis walked out, Cowlitz walked out. And later on, there was a treaty that created the Quinault Indian Reservation that came out of that, but we weren't a part of that. So to be clear, there were no such thing as federally recognized tribes and not federally recognized tribes at this time. Tribal sovereignty existed regardless of a treaty negotiation, because sovereignty stems from land and from its people. And what we now know as federal acknowledgement is a fairly new concept that came really out of the termination era. And I'll get into that in a minute. But the Chinook people, the Chinook chiefs, filed their first lawsuit against the federal government at the end of the 19th century. So, you know, in the 1800s, late 1800s, Chinook people filed a lawsuit against the federal government for taking our lands illegally. Because we really suffered when we moved out of our lands and were in a reduced capacity, because we lost access to a lot of valuable resources. And there was a lot of settlement happening at that time. And so we filed a lawsuit and we won. That lawsuit led to annuity payments for lands taken illegally in the early 1900s, 1910s. And that wouldn't be the first lawsuit. There was so many court cases, Supreme Court cases, and federal court cases that the Chinook have won over the decades. Something really important to know is that we moved from traditional form of government to a colonial structure of government in the 1920s. In 1921, we formed our first constitution, which our hereditary leaders decided on and elected our first elected form of government. And that's really when the Chinook Indian Nation solidified. And this was before the Indian Reorganization Act, which required tribes, and if they wanted to have a government-to-government relationship, to form these elected forms of government. And the constitution in which we currently exist under is from the 1950s, early 1950s, but the predecessor was the 1920s. So we actually technically have one of the longest existing constitutions of any tribe in the Pacific Northwest. That's a little bit of history about where historically we come from. But in the presence for Chinook Justice, we were treated like all the other tribes in the country until about the 1980s. And that's really when the early 80s is when the differentiation between federally recognized and not federally recognized existed. And this came at the turn of the restoration period, the beginning of the restoration period. A lot of people don't know, but in the 1950s, a lot of tribes across the country and really heavily in Oregon were terminated by the federal government. What that means is that the federal government ended their government-to-government relationships with the tribes and basically treated them as a non-Indigenous entity, denied their tribal sovereignty. And really it was, as Vine Deloria Jr. says, a way to get out of the Indian business for the federal government. And at this time, there was a lot of land dispossession occurring, and that's what it was, is about acquiring more land. And 61 tribes were listed in the Oregon Termination Act. Of those tribes, all but three have been restored. And it's really important to note that the three tribes not restored are three tribes of the Chinook Indian Nation. So I said, you know, Chinook is comprised of the Kathlamet and Clatsop of present day Oregon, the Wakayak and Willapa and Lower Chinook of what is now Washington State. The three tribes of the Chinook Indian Nation that were listed in the Western Oregon Termination Act was the Clatsop and Kathlamet of Oregon. And incorrectly, the Lower Chinook was also named. It's not historically an Oregon tribe, so it was kind of arduously listed. That being said, is that, you know, the relationship between tribes and the federal government is changing, ever changing. 50 years ago, there were no tribes in Western Oregon. 75% of the tribes in Oregon didn't exist in a legal capacity. And in Southwest Washington, there were no tribes, you know, Shoalwater Indian Bay Tribe, Cowlitz, Chehalis, they're all like relatively recently recognized by the federal government. So I guess the message there is that the government to government relationship in Indian country is not stagnant, it's ever changing. So get us to the 1970s, late 1970s. That's, you know, the restoration era. And it's also the time which the government created the list of federally recognized tribes and not federally recognized tribes. Because before this period in time, all tribes were treated equally. At this time, you know, the federal government, you know, realized, oh, we made a mistake with termination policies. People are not happy about it, but they're like, how can we reduce the budget? And so of the list of tribes, it was kind of haphazardly created, and Chinook ended up on the list of not recognized tribes. And this creation of the list of recognized versus unrecognized was a really pivotal moment for Chinook people. And at the same time that they made this list, they made an administrative process that was supposed to be timely and helpful for Indian people trying to get recognition. We were one of the first tribes to enter the administrative process through the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Department of Interior. Within a year of them creating the process, Chinook had sent a letter with an intent to go through the process, and we did. We submitted over 85,000 pieces of documentation showing our history of who we are and our connection to place. It was a 21-year process. It was not timely, and it was not friendly to the Indian people. During the Clinton administration, Kevin Gover was in charge of Indian Affairs, and he noted that there was politics interfering with Chinook's application for federal acknowledgement. And the other Indian law experts and himself wrote Chinook's final determination. And 18 months later, during a new administration, Chinook's final determination of recognition was rescinded. And the person making the decision was an engineer with no Indian law experience.
Spoken by my elders, let me see the wisdom through this eagle feather. We all sit in the circle, so let us come together. When the truth rings out, spiritless forever, will I live? Will I live? Will I live?
Yeah. That was Emma Stevens and Morgan Toney singing Willalin. And now we return to the second half of my interview with Chinook Council Member Rachel Cushman about Chinook's struggle for federal recognition.
What does federal recognition mean? What does it look like? There's several different socioeconomic factors that take into place with federal acknowledgement: access to cultural education, food, housing security, representation in government offices, the right to manage ancestral land, influence Indigenous people's daily experiences, and in the collective experience of tribes. Members of unrecognized tribes continue to practice their cultural traditions and honor Indigenous knowledge and life ways while constantly fighting for increased visibility and resources in settler colonial society. Chinook has to constantly fight to be here, to be visible, to have access to resources and protections. During the 1970s, there was a lot of other acts that happened beyond the Restoration Acts and beyond this federal acknowledgement process. You know, there's the American Indian Religious Freedom Act, there's the Self-Determination Act, there's the Indian Education Act. All of these acts were created to undo some of the harms that have been caused by settler colonial structures. Chinook doesn't get a benefit from many of those acts because of our federal status. We're still sovereign tribes because, like I said, sovereignty stems from the land and from the people. It is not bestowed upon people, but it's inherent. And so Chinook continues to practice our inherent sovereignty. But when it comes to like the everyday survival, it's really hard because we have all the problems of Indian country without the means to do anything about it. Yeah, so that's Chinook Justice in a nutshell, what our experiences have been. So Chinook Justice is, we're fighting for that recognition to be restored through Congress. This would not be the first time the U.S. senators have taken such action. The Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians was federally recognized in 2019 when a bipartisan group of U.S. senators attached a bill granting federal recognition as an amendment to a pending legislation. And we're asking our own federal leaders from Washington and Oregon to introduce a similar bill for the Chinook Indian Nation this legislative session. The Chinook Indian Nation is the only tribe currently seeking recognition whose final determination of federal recognition was rescinded by the federal government without cause.
So it seems that, you know, when you talk about politics being involved in this, and there's internal politics and intra-tribal and intra-tribal, and basically it seems to me like a lot of that's fighting over scraps. You know, Indian people have been so dispossessed and so boxed in that every little piece that we have, we're terrified of losing.
Yeah, I mean, that's a scarcity model. Definitely, there's a scarcity model that exists within Indian country. I think it's really important to know that there are a lot of tribal entities, tribal organizations, and non-tribal organizations that support Chinook's federal recognition. And, you know, we have the backing of several tribes who have publicly supported Chinook, as well as fiscally supported Chinook for our fight for recognition. We have, you know, Grand Ron is a big supporter of Chinook Indian Nation. And they, you know, they have on multiple occasions publicly supported and fiscally supported Chinook Indian Nation, as well as all of our immediate neighbors. And within our territory, every single county commission has supported Chinook Indian Nation. Many of the municipalities have supported Chinook Indian Nation. So there is a lot of support. The lateral violence, as you know, as you called it, the inter and intra relationships, is very minimal. You know, and I think a lot of people get caught up on that rather than thinking about the number of people who do support us.
You know, in my travels, when I tell people that the Chinook aren't recognized, they are actually really, really surprised. They think that, well, the Chinook, they're the historically, I mean, those are the people that Lewis and Clark met. Those are the people that are always in the books. Those are the people that everything's named after. How could you possibly not be recognized? How could you not be possibly federally recognized tribe? And how do you feel about that as you personally, and you as a woman, a mother, a human being?
How do I feel about recognition not being a reality for Chinook? My heart breaks every day. I'm going to tell you a little story because that's what we do. We tell stories, right?
Absolutely.
I was 15 years old when Chinook's federal acknowledgement was rescinded. I was on track to be a fisheries biologist, a traditional ecological knowledge keeper. And I was an apprentice for the topmost fisheries biologist in the Northwest Region's Bureau of Indian Affairs office. And I went and was hired to work for the Bureau of Indian Affairs as an Indian. And quite early on in my apprenticeship, my tribe lost federal acknowledgement by the very people who hired me as an Indian. And I was devastated. I was horrified. I got to sit in on biological opinions. I got to read treaties. Like, I spent a whole lot of time learning, you know, the government to government relation aspect of tribes. And, you know, and I also did some field work, and I was down in Northern California at the time, doing some restoration work on the ground with tribes and learning traditional ecological knowledge. And that was, you know, during the Biscuit Fire of 2002 and the fish kill of 2002 on the Klamath. And, you know, I was on the ground and I got to see other communities being harmed by decisions of the Bush administration. So 2002 was a horrible year for both the Indians and the land. And, you know, we are one. So we were just, our world was turned upside down, and I had to pivot my whole future. I wasn't going to be a fisheries biologist. That wasn't going to be in the cards for me. even though like restoration work was my life and I loved it and I did so well, but I had another role that I would have to live. And that was to be a leader of my community and fight for justice. This was a 21 year fight that we did all the things. And then to have an engineer reverse the decision, not on our own merit, but because of politics, was just disgusting. And when I went to work, somebody came up to me and said, "Sorry, you're not an Indian anymore," because it could be easily taken like that. And that, you know, I try to remind people that we're all vulnerable. And that unless we work together, we'll continue to all be vulnerable to loss of rights. Anybody could have it happen to them because Congress or whoever makes a decision. What's happened to Chinook is not something that is unique to us. But in regards to what it means, so I've grown up the latter half of my life, my adulthood, fighting for justice. When I was going to college, I had made it to the finals for the Gates Millennium Scholarship. I'd done all the work. I'd worked really hard for it. But because of my tribe status, I lost that scholarship. And that was devastating. All of my future had changed yet again because of my tribal status. And what lack of federal recognition means is that our kids aren't protected. Our graves aren't protected. Our education is not protected. There's so many inequities occurring in Indian country between who is recognized and who is not, even though we've all had the same experience. And, you know, I serve on a lot of natural resource organizations, committees, and I have to fight twice as hard to even have a seat at the table or a voice because, you know, consultations aren't required with not federally recognized tribes. Even though it's the right thing to do and tribal sovereignty is inherent, people aren't willing to do what's right all the time. They need a mandate to tell them it's right. You know, but we do enact our sovereignty regardless. And so it's a lot of my time and energy is spent on educating and re-educating and talking about how colonization has truly impacted our communities and how this whole battle is a product of it, of that colonization.
So you know, you talked about your background and going into fish biology and trying to really work on your responsibility to the land, which is responsibility of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got that tradition. And, you know, a minute ago you said your tribal chair at the time was so devastated that he cut his hair. For those who don't know, that is a sign of deep, emotional and painful situation, death, basically, usually reserved for death. And to him, that was the death, you know, that was a death. And we need to start thinking more about our environment and climate collapse and what that means. And you know, our responsibility to generations in front of us. How do you explain how we feel and how you feel about your responsibility to the world around you and how that differs with the Judeo-Christian ethic of dominion over the earth and dominion over everything that surrounds human beings? What can you give me a little insight into that?
Well, we don't believe in dominion over anything. We are in relation with the earth in an indigenous worldview or an indigenous paradigm. You know, there is no distinction between the living and the non-living, the natural world and people. We are all interconnected and we rely on each other for our future. And I was raised with Chinookan protocols, and those are our teachings that come from the past that, if followed, will lead to strength, cultural strength. They'll lead to a good life. And we don't control the natural world. We steward it. So we take care of it. We care for it. We don't use in excess. We use what we need, and we make sure that there's plentiful for the future generations. A lot of folks think in generations. We don't think in, a 5-year plan, 3-year plan, a decade plan, 25-year plan. No, we think generations out. So when my grandfather Wasilta negotiated and signed the treaties in 1851, he thought of me. I was the 7th generation from him. And it's my duty to think that far in the future for the next generations. We want to remain here. Chinook people have been on the landscape for over 10,000 years, and we plan on to be on the landscape for another 10,000 years or more. But we can only do that if we're taking care of it. One of the ways that I approach organizations is a shared responsibility, that a lot of people are fearful of the term land back. No, it's not something to be feared. It is something to be celebrated, to have autonomy on the landscape, to be able to do what we've done for 10,000 years, because it was a thriving space until Western world came and decided to have dominion over it and to extract resources in an unhealthy way. But if we can steward and have autonomy within our landscape, we can change the trajectory of the future.
Right. So what are things that people can do to assist the Chinook Nation in regaining their recognition?
So there's several aspects of the Chinook Justice campaign. For more detailed history of Chinook, you could visit ChinookNation.org. But for Chinook Justice specifically and how to be an ally and supporter, we have ChinookJustice.org. We also have Chinook_Nation on Twitter and at Everyday Chinook on Instagram. And follow and, stay connected on those. But on our ChinookJustice.org website, there's multiple ways to engage. There is a petition that's being signed, which, tens of thousands of people have signed the petitions. You could write letters to your elected leaders. There is, a donate button. It's also very helpful if folks don't have the time to help with direct actions, they have the means to donate. We always appreciate it. We also are doing a number of Chinook Justice rallies. We're trying to do them as often as possible to just build momentum, which is really awesome. We have both in-person and online abilities for those rallies. So you can, if you can't join in person, you can join online. We have Twitter storms that are happening. There's a lot that you can do for Chinook Justice. But one of the most important things is just learning the history and understanding that federal acknowledgement is a fairly new process, and it's a harmful thing, that there's a lot of inequities that exist for tribes without federal acknowledgement, and that an educated populace is, an informed populace can really make a difference.
Great. Well, I appreciate that. Well, thank you, Rachel. I really appreciate your time, and I hope that we get a chance to do some more interviews and get the word out, and we will have some of the places you just mentioned on the KBOO website. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Down that bag of potato chips, that white bread, that bottle of pop. Turn off that cell phone, computer, and remote control. Open the door, then close it behind you. Take a breath offered by friendly winds.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. I'm Robin White, your host for this Indigenous Peoples Day show. That was Joy Harjo singing Calling the Spirit Back. And before that, you were listening to my interview with Chinook Tribal Council member Rachel Cushman, speaking about the Chinook struggle for tribal recognition. This is Lakota Cheyenne Mole Robin White. I've been your host for today's Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. We'll be playing out today's show with Pura Faye singing My People, My Land.
Thank you to Moles Robin White and Julian Ankney for their contributions this morning. A special thanks to our guests, Julian Matthews and Rachel Cushman. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I produce today's Indigenous Peoples Day special for the Old Mole with production and editing assistance from Desiree Helligers. Thanks for listening.
Here we thrive. My people, my love.